This is All In. I'm Miriam Soeb. Today is the Friday recap where we revisit a few of the most interesting conversations we had this week. Up first, we'll hear from a professor about the psychology behind conspiratorial thinking and misinformation. We're talking about misinformation and conspiracy theories with psychology and media experts. If you have questions or comments on our show today, let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. Again, that's 866-476-3881. You can also send us a digital voice message with our smartphone app. It's called All In Vox Pop. Just look for it in your phone's app store. With us live now from Brussels is Stephen Lewandowski, Chair in Cognitive Psychology at the University of Bristol. Welcome, Stephen. Thank you so much for staying up late to join us today.
Thanks. It's a pleasure to be here.
So, wow, so much to talk about, and I know you're an expert in so many different areas on this, so we'll start with something simple first here. What are you most interested in learning right now about misinformation and conspiracy theories?
Well, obviously, what I'm most interested in is how we can sort of get them under control. And I personally think that what we have to look at is we have to understand the social media landscape and the social media business model, which I think is in part at least responsible for what we're seeing now. And one of the reasons I'm in Brussels at the moment is because I'm working with the European Commission to think about ways in which we might improve the online environment and make it more compatible with deliberative democracy than it is now at the moment. At the moment, what happens is that pretty much everything online is geared towards capturing your attention. If you go online, be it Facebook or Twitter or any other social media, it's all about your attention. That is what is being sold to advertisers. That is what's being monetized. Now, if you have an economy where attention is the only commodity of interest, then it would be miraculous indeed if that economy gave rise to quality information. Well, guess what? It doesn't, because things that attract attention tend to be new and novel and outrageous. And of course, that is precisely what conspiracy theories and disinformation is all about. And that, I think, is where the core of the problem lies.
Speaking of social media and how, you know, things have to capture your attention, I often wonder, is there a limit on how outrageous something can be? Because it seems like you have to, like, raise the bar every time on how to get someone to click on something. Is there a limit?
Well, that's a very good question. I sometimes wonder myself, you know, 5 years ago, somebody said to me that, you know, there'll be a serious discussion about whether or not the earth is flat on social media, I would have said, well, no way. I mean, that is just too far out. And yet that is precisely what is happening now. There are some people out there who succumb to that particular belief, which, of course, we know to be false. And one of the interesting reasons why this can happen is because what social media does for the first time in human history is to allow people to connect across vast distances. And what that implies is that any belief, no matter how absurd, can find a community online that in reality you would never find. In the 19th century or even the early 20th century, if I had thought the earth was flat, no one in my village or neighborhood would have believed that. Today, I can jump on Facebook and I can find others who think like that, even though they're just a tiny number of people dispersed around the world. Now, one consequence of people believing that their beliefs are shared by others is that we become resistant to correction. So the more I think other people share my views, the less likely I am to change my views. And that is another novelty that social media has introduced that we've never had to contend with before.
Right, right. And so I wonder, you know, as you've been looking into this and studying this, are there any specific areas around sort of the psychology behind these issues that people are still trying to understand in the research realm? Is there anything still mysterious about how it is that people succumb to some of these ideologies?
Well, that's a very good question because in a sense, we do know a lot about why that happens. For example, we do know why some people are susceptible to conspiracy theories. And we know that in a pandemic in particular, whenever people feel that they've lost control over their lives, when they're scared, when they don't know what to do to cope with a risk, under those circumstances, we know that people become more susceptible to conspiracy theories. That's been the case for centuries. We know that from previous pandemics. So pandemics are a factory that is cranking out people who believe in conspiracy theories for psychological reasons that are well understood, because believing in a conspiracy can offer people a sense of comfort. If I can blame everything that happens in the world on, you know, Bill Gates or George Soros or Al Gore or somebody, whoever it is, then that gives me the ability to think the world might be different if that person hadn't been so evil. And some people derive psychological comfort from that ability. They find that easier to take than to accept the fact that the pandemic can arrive at random from a bat in China.
Mm-hmm. And is it also that it offers people sort of a sense of control? I don't know if it's human nature where we want to have control over our environment.
Oh, yes, absolutely. There's no question. I mean, and we can, in laboratory experiments, we can turn that on and off. If you deny people control, they become more likely to detect pattern in random dots where there is no pattern. And that is precisely what a conspiracy theory is. It is basically a pattern detection when, in fact, we're just talking about random events. And lack of control is causing that. Mm-hmm. And giving people control, we also know, is attenuating that risk. So anything we can do right now to give people a sense of control is going to be a positive move towards reducing the influence of conspiracy theories.
And now that I'm thinking about it, with social media, does that maybe increase people's feeling of lack of control in some instances? Because you might post something, but you don't know what's going to become of it.
Well, that's a good point. I never thought of that before. But yes, I mean, so social media give us control? Well, I don't know. I mean, I spend a lot of time on social media. I find it rewarding because I learn a lot. You know, if you follow scientists on Twitter, you learn a lot from their publications. But yeah, I suspect it's not giving me a greater sense of control. So that's a good possibility.
Yeah. I mean, I have so much interest in social media and seeing where it's going. You know, I was one of those early adopters way back in the day, and I've seen the changes. So yes, I could talk about this forever. But I do want to get back to talking a little bit about misinformation. How would you define that term? And is there a difference between misinformation and disinformation?
Yeah, very good question. Well, first of all, psychologically, I think any misinformation, which is simply information that turns out to be false after you first believe it, any such information psychologically is probably functioning in a very similar way. And what we know about such misinformation is that if you tell people something is wrong after they first believe it, they will, on the one hand, tell you, oh, yeah, I know, you told me that's wrong. But on the other hand, in a different context, when we're asking them to make use of information in a reasoning task, for example, they will still rely on the false information. And we call that the continued influence effect. And that is an incredibly robust and replicated finding. You know, people will accept a correction. They'll say, yeah, I know that's false. And then they're going to use that information 10 or 20 seconds later in a different context. And that's what makes it problematic, because corrections don't always work. Now, disinformation is also misinformation, but by my definition, it comes with the additional intent to deceive. Disinformation is something that is produced by people who do it for political or economic purposes, or just to, you know, satisfy their own emotional needs, but with intent to deceive. And so online, I think we get a mix of both. There is a lot of misinformation out there that's kind of incidental. People didn't know it was wrong. But then there is also disinformation out there that is being spread, mainly mm-hmm. for political reasons.
So I guess what you're saying is that misinformation is sort of unintentional, and whereas disinformation is very intentional with some kind of goal in mind.
Precisely. Mm-hmm.
And so what is the difference between a conspiracy theory and misinformation? I mean, can those kind of coincide together?
Well, in fact, they almost necessarily do. I mean, conspiracy theories, by definition, because they're theories other than actual conspiracies, they're based on misinformation or disinformation. Now, that doesn't mean that every form of disinformation is a conspiracy theory. For example, when Donald Trump claimed that more people attended his inauguration than any other inauguration in history, well, that was plain false. I mean, it was totally false. But it wasn't a conspiracy theory. So you can be misleading without engaging in a conspiracy theory. Now, how do we detect a conspiracy theory? Well, it turns out that there is a catalog of reasons, a catalog of symptoms of the cognition of people who believe in conspiracy theories that we can exploit to determine whether somebody is engaging in conspiratorial rhetoric. And one marker that I particularly like is the incoherence of conspiracy theories. You know, there are people who say that COVID is a hoax and doesn't kill anyone. But in the next sentence, half a second later, they say, oh, it's a Chinese bioweapon that was designed to kill us all. Well, come on, either it's harmless or it's going to kill us. It can't be, you know, it can't be both. And that sort of incoherence is typical of conspiracy theories. And that's, in fact, one of the things we can teach people in some of our experiments to, you know, train them so they can detect when they're being misled and they become less susceptible to misinformation.
Coming up next on the Friday Recap, we'll hear from a researcher about precarious employment and the health of workers in low-quality jobs. A little later in the program, we'll learn about how art can be an effective way to heal from stress and trauma. And a reminder, this show is taped and not live, but we always welcome your feedback. Find us on Twitter and Facebook at All in Indiana, or give us a call at 866-476-3881. I'm Miriam Sobe. This is All In. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. And it's the Friday Recap, where we revisit a few conversations we had over the last week. Coming up, a researcher talks about precarious employment and the health of workers in low-quality jobs. A quick reminder, this show is taped and not live, but you can always reach out to us on Twitter or Facebook at All in Indiana, or leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. With us now is Emily Ahonen, Associate Professor at Indiana University Richard M. Fairbanks School of Public Health. Welcome, Emily. Can you tell us a bit about this research project you're a part of?
Sure. When my collaborators and I have been focused on work understood broadly and its relationship to health equity for a while. And so when the COVID-19 pandemic hit, we started thinking about what precarious employment might mean specifically during the pandemic. And we started thinking, you know, workers in the food sector are critical to maintaining and securing our food supply. Older workers in essential food provision positions face a disproportionate burden of exposure and consequences. And there's also a disproportionate representation of people of color in essential food jobs. And that might be contributing to the high burden of COVID-19 in those populations. And we also figured that because of the nature of their jobs, many food workers might not be able to follow prevention guidelines and social distance because of their work. So as we were thinking about all these issues and the fact that American society was depending on precariously employed workers to ensure our access to essential goods and services, we wanted to describe how precarious employment might shape access to resources and opportunities necessary to prevent the coronavirus. And so that's where we got started with the study.
And what made you focus? I think you were specifically focusing on food workers for this project. What made you go that route?
Well, what we started noticing was when we started deeming certain groups of work essential, that some of those groups of workers got a lot more attention and would have been a lot more practiced at prevention of infectious diseases than others. So, you know, for instance, medical care workers have a lot of experience with using that sort of PPE and infection control. But other essential workers, like those responsible for ensuring our food supply, don't deal with this on a daily basis, and they were getting talked about a lot less, but they're quite a big portion of the labor force. And so because of that, and because so many food workers are precariously employed, we thought that this was a group of people whose work experiences needed some extra attention.
Right, right. Well, you've mentioned the precariously employed, and I'm hoping we can sort of define what that is a little bit for our audience, and what that means. What is a precarious employee or precarious employment?
Sure. Well, I'll begin by saying that precarious employment is based on the employment relationship. So that means, you know, someone has a job working for someone else, and that defines their relationship. And definitions of precarious employment have shifted a little over time. But in general, when we say precarious employment, what we mean is employment that accumulates traits that are less desirable for workers. And it's generally referring to things like instability or insecurity in that relationship, how long the job might last under what conditions. It often means inadequate income and a lack of rights and social protections. So things like access to unemployment benefits if the job is lost. And when a job accumulates those sorts of unwanted factors, we call that precarious employment.
Mm-hmm. Are there any jobs that people would be surprised to find out they fall under precarious employment? Like, would a freelancer fall under that?
Well, that's part of the area where definitions are evolving and changing, because one aspect of precarious employment is a relationship to an employer. And so when freelancers are working for someone else and they have this sort of unpredictability or inadequate pay and lack of access to social protections, then we might start talking about that work as precarious.
Okay. And if someone was looking for signs to know whether they are in a situation like that, is there anything specific? I know you mentioned insecure about whether you're still going to have your job or not. Maybe there's no benefits. Is there anything else?
Well, we often talk about whether or not people have ability to grow and evolve in a job, and whether they have control over when they work, their working times, and whether that's predictable. And we also think about things like interpersonal power. So how much influence do people have about things like working time or about their pay? And do they feel that they can broach those issues without fear of losing that job? So some of those things come along with many situations of precarious employment.
Mm-hmm. I'm just thinking back to past jobs I've had, and I'm wondering, was I ever in that situation where, you know, it's like every week the schedule is completely different and you don't know, and you get called in, and if you don't show up, it's like, well, we'll just find someone else. And it's very stressful.
Sure. Yeah. And I think one thing it's important to say about precarious employment is that whether or not people use that name to define their experiences, certainly when you start talking to people about aspects of what makes employment precarious, like things you're saying, unpredictability, lack of control, potential to be fired abruptly, they're intimately familiar with that reality, and they will know whether they experience those things, whether or not they would use the term for precarious employment to define that experience. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's one of the reasons that talking about things by name sometimes matters and sometimes doesn't. People's realities don't change regardless of what we call them. But I think in terms of social dialogue, when we start naming something and start calling it an experience in itself, we might start to question whether it has to be that way or whether the circumstances could be changed.
Right, right. Well, do you think this type of employment is more common than we realize? Is that what's moving most of the industries around us?
Well, I guess whether we think about how common it is or not, studies in the U.S. are still in early days of precarious employment, but a few recent studies using big nationally representative data sets have suggested that between, 12 and 31% of people in those samples anyway could be called precariously employed, depending on what aspects were included in the researchers' definitions. And so that's not a small proportion of the U.S. labor force. And to the second part of your question, this is not a thing that is limited to certain industries. Precarious employment can exist in any kind of occupation or industry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, as you were talking about the definitions and things, I was realizing that. I think when I've heard the term before, I just automatically thought it was, an entry-level job where you're just trying to make it. And, people are like, you got to make your way up the ladder and pay your dues. But it can be anything, really. You could be at advanced level in your company and still face it.
You could, and you're bringing up an important point about precarious employment's relationship to health. And that's that some of its influence on health appears to depend on life phase. So, at different points in our life, what we need and expect from employment are different. And our health as people is constantly evolving over time. And so, when you refer to somebody who's just starting out and thinking that this might be a stepping stone to something else, there are specific forms of precarious employment that refer to that reality. And then there's the sort of precarious employment where it may or may not change and workers are in a life phase where that is going to be more problematic for them.
Mm-hmm. Well, how does one change the idea that this is just the way things are when it comes to precarious employment?
Well, I think one way to answer your question is that when we start thinking about employment more structurally, right? Sometimes we can think of jobs in a very small way, right? This one job is like this, or a certain kind of person has jobs like this. But when we think about work and employment as an institution that societies create, that we collectively create, we can also think about ways to change it to work better for us. And, that doesn't happen overnight, but it can and does happen. Think, for instance, about limits on daily or weekly work hours or days off. There's an old joke that unions are the group that brought us the weekend, right? Mm-hmm. And we can make that joke because there was a time when we didn't think of employment as something that everyone deserved time off from. And so I think one way to think of precarious employment as not inevitable is when we think about employment and work as experiences that we've invented as societies and we collectively shape, and we can reshape them to be better for us.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. If you have any questions or comments for our guests today, you can find us on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. I want to talk a little bit more about sort of the health issues related to precarious employment. Do you think the pandemic highlighted some of the health issues surrounding that?
I would say that it certainly brought employment quality and precarious employment to the forefront in a way that I haven't seen in my career before. Precarious employment is sort of an understudied determinant of health, but as the pandemic unraveled, it became pretty apparent that many workers are simultaneously experiencing high levels of contact with the public, which we now know is really important to the spread of the coronavirus, but they also might not be able to practice strict social distancing, work remotely from home. They might not even have paid time off. And so all of these things that workers have experienced for a long time, including work that isn't especially well paid, all of those things became very clear in the pandemic, where staying home might be really important to prevent infection, but might be really problematic for people who aren't very highly paid and don't have paid time off. They may not have a lot of savings to fall back on if they needed or wanted to stay home. And so I think we've begun to talk more about employment and also to start to think about how reliant employees are on their employers and government policy to provide them with protections when we are faced with extreme situations.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, how are people's health directly affected by precarious employment? Is there like a trend that you see among the folks that you've been studying?
Well, research on precarious employment and health is fairly early in the U.S. And what we think is that the ways that precarious employment is attached to health is through these sort of material limitations we've been talking about, right? Not enough money or not enough money to buy tangible things that people need. Also through exposure to occupational hazards and through employment-related stressors like feeling insecure or feeling a sense of unfairness about pay or circumstances. And what we see in the U.S. so far is that those people who have precarious employment compared to better quality employment situations tend to report poorer self-rated health, like when people get asked to generally say how healthy they are. And they tend to report a higher prevalence of different forms of psychological distress than people who have higher quality employment.
Yeah, I mean, I can imagine if it's so unpredictable, that just cannot be good. That can be very stressful.
Yeah, people are very creative and resourceful, but these are real strains that come with precarious employment situations.
Well, are there any resources out there to help folks who find themselves in these kinds of situations?
There are, and I would start by saying that anything that puts workers in connection and solidarity with each other can help over time. So things like worker centers, unions, even staff committees within a workplace can be good tools for workers to use to come together and talk about their employment situations. And that can bring forth more ideas and good strategies for advocating for themselves for changes that might support them. The other thing that I would say is that elected officials are a huge part of shaping what is possible in terms of employment laws and enforcement of them and who has access to what resources and protections. And so we can and should make our elected officials at the city, state, and federal level aware that precarious employment matters to us and to our communities. And so helping them understand that support of their constituents in this way is an opportunity to leverage employment as a positive for the health of their constituent communities. And so we can think about each other as resources because we're all part of this society that we can shape. And we can think about those people who we've given official titles to use to advocate for us as responsible for working on that as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, you mentioned unions and things like that. Would a union replace laws or would laws be better than unions to address precarious employment?
I would not take either of those things off the table. I think, you know, because they're both relevant, right? Laws and enforcement about what's allowed in employment relationships are really important. They historically shape what employers do. Employers are really important because they have the power to shape what employment experiences are like for people who work in their companies. And unions, historically, or other worker collectives like worker centers or worker advocacy groups, can help shift that power balance between employer and employee that determine what employment is like for workers. And so I would say all of those efforts at all of those levels are necessary in order to improve precarious employment.
Mm-hmm. Well, we have about a minute left. I wanted to ask you what's next with your research and where things stand.
Right now, we're collecting data actively. And so we really would like to hear from food workers who are older than 50 in Indiana or Washington state who think they might have experienced precarious employment during the pandemic and to tell us about what that was like for them. So we're collecting data right now, and we will analyze those data as we have them and see what we can find that might influence public health messaging and prevention practices at work, and over time, hopefully contribute to better support for precariously employed people.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Emily, for your time today. We'll definitely want to check in once that study is complete and see what you found.
Thank you.
Emily Quinn-Ihonen is an associate professor at Indiana University Richard M. Fairbanks School of Public Health. We'll be back after a quick break. We'll continue our conversation on precarious employment and talk about what's going on here in Indiana. If you have any questions or comments for our guests today, you can find us on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881, or you can send us a voice message without having to make a call. You can just use our smartphone app. It's called All in Vox Pop, free and easy to use. Just search for All in Vox Pop on your phone's app store. That's VOXPOP. I'm Miriam Soeb. Back in 90 seconds, this is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Soeb. It's the Friday recap where we look back at some of our favorite conversations we had this week. We just heard from a researcher talking about precarious employment and the health of workers in low-quality jobs. Now we'll learn about how art can be an effective way to heal from stress and trauma through clinical art therapy. We're joined now by Michelle Waukee Thornburg, a licensed mental health counselor and registered art therapist at the Brain Center in Indianapolis. Welcome to the program, Michelle.
Thank you for having me, Miriam.
Well, let's start with art therapy. How long has this practice been around?
Goodness. Okay, so I like that question. Thank you. Because a lot of people don't really know the history of art therapy. It's been around for a long time. So around the 40s, right, came around. And when art therapy first appeared as a form of psychotherapy, it was rooted in psychoanalysis. So think of Freud and Jung in that case. Mm-hmm. So the idea of the artwork or art expression is thought of as a reflection of the art maker's unconscious and was a natural fit with those central concepts of the psychoanalytic and Jungian theory. So it stresses the importance of the individual's internal world.
That's interesting, because I think sometimes when we think of art therapy, it sounds like some new thing that popped up like 10 years ago, but it's actually been around for a long time.
It's been around for a long time, yes. People have a tendency to confuse it with art class or, various other things. Mm-hmm. And in art therapy, we have this concept of isomorphism. It's not isolated to art therapy, but in terms of art therapy, when we think of how to describe the art product, it's an external representation of the internal state of the client, mm-hmm. right? So it's like our inside, what's going on in our body and mind is coming out through the art.
And so are there different ways that that's expressed in art therapy?
Yes. So for instance, guiding a client through the therapeutic process, for example, if a person is struggling with control or maybe they're agitated, to help them become a little more centered and be more at ease, I wouldn't necessarily choose watercolor, right, as a medium, because it's the most fluid, it's unpredictable, hard to control. But what I may do is suggest something like oil pastels, because it's still fluid, but it's more restrictive than watercolor. And the client can still feel some sense of control.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, that's very fascinating. And I think it really helps to dispel some of these misconceptions where, I mean, myself included, where I'm just like, oh, art therapy, you just go to a therapist and they're like, here, draw something, you know? So it's very interesting to see that it's tailored specifically to whatever they're going through.
Well, think back to what Yavi and Britt said, you know, through art, actually, we can tell our own stories, our own experiences.
Mm-hmm.
So think of that in those terms as well. So we have, you know, we have art therapy and we have talk therapy, right? Mm-hmm. So art therapists are trained when to offer which types of materials, which art prompts to give, how to support the creative process as it's unfolding. You have different materials that interact with different parts of the brain. So there are many factors involved. So that's when you start to bring in that neuroscience, right? That element. Art therapists also bear witness and hold space for clients to create. Very similar to talk therapy in that sense, right?
Mm-hmm.
A mental health counselor is trained to utilize a variety of theoretical perspectives. Within those perspectives, tons and tons of theories, mm-hmm. intervention, also bearing witness and holding space. Very similar in that sense to talk therapy. the art therapist is combining theories of creativity, drawing development, psychosocial models, and probably actually more than that, but combining those with the major perspectives in psychology, right? The biology, psychodynamic, behavioral, cognitive, humanistic. You're taking those, and within that, those theories, art therapists, you're adding on more to that. We're utilizing the expressive therapies continuum, right? It's kind of our framework where, like I just explained, how to use a material in what context. This ETC, or expressive therapies continuum, it helps us with the organization of assessment information, formulation of treatment goals, and the planning of art therapy interventions.
Now, for someone who would be interested in this field, I'm just curious, like, would you have to be a skilled artist to be an art therapist?
Not necessarily. I have a BFA in sculpture, so I went to art school. I have a fine art degree. But a lot of art therapists I've met did not have that background, and it's not necessarily required, right? So if a client of art therapy does not need to have, it's not about the skill. Right? It has nothing to do with art skill. And in terms of the art therapist, as long as they're comfortable utilizing the art materials and understanding that process, going through that process themselves, it's not required that you're a fine artist.
Okay. And I know you gave us some example about how you could use art in a session. Are there any other sort of things that maybe people wouldn't realize is used in session?
Just about anything and everything can be used in terms of creativity. Now, when you're talking about assessments, right? Assessments in art therapy are very specific. We're utilizing a certain size of paper, certain media, maybe a pencil or colored pencils or markers. So some things are a little more strict in that sense, right? Because we have that spectrum of art as therapy versus art psychotherapy. So we're going to do more on that art psychotherapy realm. We're going to do a little more clinical work utilizing assessments. But we can also do things like art as therapy, which I do in my own life, but can be incorporated into session where you're using materials as a way of soothing and coping, right? So maybe say you take a paintbrush and you're just moving that paintbrush back and forth, right? You're just creating this self-soothing moment here. Or maybe you're taking some colored pencils and you're coloring within a circle. We call a mandala. We use that a lot in art therapy to help, you know, contain emotions. And so there's just a variety of things that can be done. All art therapists are so different, you know, just as artist therapy and art psychotherapy is a big spectrum. Art therapists are there as well. Not all art therapists are licensed mental health counselors. So some art therapists have a master's in art therapy. And some have included that sort of hybrid degree, which I have, the licensed mental health counseling as well. So there's such a variety when it comes to, you know, what happens in the office with the clients.
So I would assume it's up to the client to sort of research and figure out which route they want to go.
In some ways, you know, we can also help just through assessment, just figuring out what it is the client is interested in. So essentially it's, you know, it is psychotherapy. We're utilizing all these theories in art therapy as a modality to come to the similar to same conclusion as you would in talk therapy. Right.
Right. Right. And what about, I mean, you're with the Brain Center right now. What are some of the things that are done at the center?
So Dr. April Crowell is the owner of the Brain Center, and she's a clinical neuropsychologist. And so she offers full psychological testing. And we also offer therapy services, such as like my degree, right? The LMHC or in art therapy as well. So that's a combination of the two. And so there's an office in McCordsville, Indianapolis. And so it's growing. It's in the process of growing. So right now that's about what's going on there.
Mm-hmm. And what about I'm curious about when we talk about accessibility, like earlier we were talking about accessibility to art programs like ArtMix. How is accessibility with art therapy? Are there enough art therapists? Is this publicized enough?
Oh, great question. So on, you know, I'm advertising it on the Brain Center website, right? And I'm also advertising a group for teenagers, art therapy group. So there are ways of advertising. Now, what's interesting is, so I'm a member of the American Art Therapy Association, right? Which is much larger, right? And then you have the local Indian Art Therapy Association. I'm also a member. Now, if you go on that website, you'll find an art therapist locator. But unfortunately, you're only going to find a few art therapists. Now, I don't know why it's, I don't know why this is, guys. So all the art therapists out there, please, let's get on there and make sure that we're on the locator. It's something that you have to actually register for. As a member, I made the assumption, which we, you know, we have a tendency to do make assumptions, is that we're automatically on it. We are not. So let's get out there and make sure that we're able to provide that. Now, some art therapists work in private practices, work for Riley Hospital, IU Health. It looks different all over the state. Now, at the Brain Center, we actually accept Medicaid, right, in addition to most major insurance for psychological testing and therapy, which is something people are normally surprised about. It allows for more access for individuals who may not be able to engage in services due to the cost. Now, in Indianapolis and surrounding cities, we have Indy Child Therapists. It's a private practice. They also provide art therapy. Sunstone Studios, Indiana Health Group. Martine Feist, she's an art therapist in town. She's great. In Bloomington, we have Linda Bannister. She's in Spencer Psychology. We have Greenwood Counseling Associates, Grow Counseling and Art Therapy. A friend of mine owns that, and that's in Plainfield. And so it's out there. It's not advertised as much as I personally would like it to be. Mm-hmm. So I think we need to have a little more information out there that's accessible to everyone that's interested in that practice and understanding it better.
Yeah. I mean, and you mentioned that at the Brain Center, they take Medicaid. And I'm curious, do most insurance plans cover art therapy?
No. So what's lovely about the Indiana chapter, Art Therapy Association, is, and, you know, if you guys are interested, take a look at the website, because they're always working hard to change legislation, right? So as a licensed mental health counselor, I can bill for services, right? As an art therapist, I cannot. Mm-hmm. So there's a difference. It's not a license. Now, they're working on it. They're working on it all the time. They're working on it. They work so hard on it to have that change for us so that art therapists can bill just like a licensed mental health counselor.
Yeah. And it's, again, I'm going to go back to the fact that art therapy has been around, you said, since the 40s, but for some reason it just seems so new when you're trying to get legislation going. It's like, wait, did this just happen?
You want to hear something more interesting is that during Pence's time as vice president, his wife, that was her platform. Karen Pence's platform was art therapy.
Oh, wow.
So, okay. And who is, you know, how many people have heard that? So it's just, it's out there. It's just not talked about as much as we would like. Again, a lot of stigmas. And the more, you know, it is, things are changing. And so our field is, more people are interested, right? I'm on this show talking about it right now. There's interest in it.
Mm-hmm. And what would you say to somebody that's interested in perhaps pursuing therapy and going in the art therapy route? What would you say if they're like hesitant, like, I want to do it, but I'm not sure?
Well, as with anything, you know, you take that chance and try it out. Maybe look online and read a little bit about it. If you want to engage in something creative, to learn more about yourself, it's, you know, it's to really help increase and enhance self-awareness. Right? Identify strengths, develop interpersonal skills. There's so much that can happen with it. So it's really the approach that works for you. Some clients I have are only talk therapy. They really prefer not to engage in that creative element. However, there are times when, you know, eventually they ask to engage in it. So it's really individualized. It's really up to the person in the way that they want to heal.
Mm-hmm. And what's next for you? I know you're with the Brain Center. Is there anything else you're working on?
Well, I'm always working on something new. I am in the earliest stages, if you can be, and, you know, starting my own practice. That's way in the future here. So that is something I'm working on. It's a lot of work that goes into that. I'm also working on getting more art therapy groups together. It's such a beautiful experience to engage in a group setting. Also working on my own art. When Yabi and Britt were talking earlier about, you know, engaging in art, right? And how, as a way of coping through the pandemic. So my husband and I, and our good friends, David, Yosha, and Dorothy Hinkle, what we did was, as a way of coping through that, was we engaged with the Arts Council for the March Madness, artwork for March Madness. So that downtown work, if you saw that. A lot of artwork printed on vinyl. We decided to do a collaboration, a three-dimensional collaboration installation called Multiverse. So we were able to experience, you know, making art in that context. It was therapeutic. It was cathartic. And so I'm interested in maybe doing a little bit more of that public work, as well as just what I do to cope, you know, just making little things here and there.
Yeah. And I wonder, did you see a lot of clients during the pandemic that were more interested in the artistic aspect?
Yes, very much so. You know, it's amazing with art therapy. There's just so much, you know, we could talk for days on this. Mm-hmm. But we think in images, and we thought in images before there were words, right? Before we spoke words. So it plays a large part in our development, and it's a way to communicate without really having to say the words. And it helps us find the words. So I did find at that, you know, during the pandemic, clients were more, you know, interested in engaging with materials. Being creative and engaging, clients appear to be more open, revealing, and receptive during and after engaging in art making. So there is something there. And so that pandemic kind of pushed it a little more for everyone.
Right, right. Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us today and sharing your insight. Michelle Waukee Thornburg is a licensed mental health counselor and registered art therapist at the Brain Center in Indianapolis. Thank you so much for joining us. Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Mike Yason. Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme song. If you'd like a podcast of this show or any past show, you can find it anywhere you get your podcasts. And you can always get in touch with us by finding us on Twitter and Facebook at All in Indiana. Or you can leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. That's it for the Friday Recap. I'm Miriam Sobe. Thanks for listening. This is All In.